it is Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hello and welcome back to Chronicles, where today Stelios and I are going to be rounding off our grand discussion about an even grander tale, which is, of course, the Argonautica, the tale of Jason and the Argonauts, Jason and the Golden Fleece. And I suppose that is appropriate, given that that is the very point in the story that we finally come to, of course, Jason and the rest of his Argonauts, you know, his mariners aboard the Argo, the divinely created ship with the help of Argus and Athena, has managed to, you know, sail them all the way across the Aegean. They've gone up through the Bosphorus, they've gone into the Black Sea, and in the last part that we discussed together, of course, they finally managed to find their way to the court of Aeetes at the far ends of the known world on the east of the Black Sea and the city of Colchis. And we've obviously had a lot to say about it all. We had a lot to say about Jason as a leader, as a hero, and how atypical he is compared to some of the other, you know, Homeric type of figures. And so we're coming to a head now of the completion of the quest.
Yes, and one of the things that we have to mention is that Apollonius of Rhodes has a very dense style of writing.
Mm.
So this version is just 140 pages.
Yeah.
And it contains a multitude of events.
Mm.
It's easy to forget some of them because there's just so many.
Especially when you're dealing with something like Greek mythology, where there's an entire lore and history behind every name.
Yes.
And, you know, it's just so extensive. You could spend far longer than we've been spending on it now, though we feel like this works as a wonderful introduction
and
for you.
He gives me the impression that he was writing expecting a sort of a massive siege or something, massive destruction, which is like, right, I have 140 pages. How can I fit as many events as possible in them?
Yeah.
And people who have watched the movie, I think it was from 1963,
and the Harryhausen.
Obviously, the movie doesn't have many of the events that happened in book four. And especially in book four, there is a surprising commonality between the Argonautica and the Odyssey.
Yes.
The trajectory. So Jason is going through lots of the through a very similar itinerary.
Yes.
He fights same monsters.
He meets Cersei.
Meets same people.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting to see how Jason compares in comparison to Odysseus.
We will definitely talk about it. But one of the things to mention when we're talking about mythography, which is writing about myths, is that it was simultaneously narration, but also them trying to educate people about the world.
Mm.
So it's not a coincidence that you see Jason going through the same quest that Odysseus did. And I'm putting it in that way because the Odyssey was written is a far older text than the Argonautica. Apollonius of Rhodes writes 3-4 centuries or perhaps more.
Yeah.
Perhaps later than Homer did. So it was them just saying that let us remind you of the entire lore in as concise way as possible.
Yeah, and just to remind you, if it's been a week since you last saw, just to recap some of the broad strokes of what happened, particularly in book three, of course, is that when Jason arrives at the court of Aeetes, who is a very tyrannical figure, you know, and everything about the grandeur of Colchis and the fact that all of its architecture is fashioned by Hephaestus himself. And you have this rich abundance, you know, these springs that, you know, it just speaks to the enormous divine wealth that Aeetes has in his kingdom. But of course, like before when they were fighting the Bibrichians. You know, that was kind of a foreshadowing for the fact that, look, Aeetes is a man who has very barely any redeeming qualities, right? The only thing you could really say that he has going for him is that he is feared and respected, and that that fear and respect manages to create a certain level of order in his kingdom. However, that is does come at the expense of a great deal of justice. And we see this in how hostile he is to Jason when Jason and the Argonauts first arrive in his kingdom. And one thing that I think wasn't mentioned in when we discussed Book 3, but is worth mentioning, is the fact that Argos, the son of Phrixos, had mentioned, no, sorry, it's Aeetes himself. He recounts when Phrixos first arrived in Colchis all those years ago, you know, when he first flew there on the back of the golden ram, that the only reason Aeetes actually accepted Phrixos into his kingdom and allowed him to marry his own daughter Chalciope was because Zeus demanded it. Yeah. And Hermes demanded it. But that just means that left to his own natural devices and his own natural persuasions, Aeetes is not a man of hospitality. He is not a generous man.
He isn't a generous man, and he's a very tyrannical father. Mm. But also, Jason asked him to part with the symbol of his authorities, like going to a king and tell him, give me your scepter.
Yes.
So he wasn't going to take that well.
No. And that is also at the expense of the fact that Jason tried to reason with Aeetes that, look, if you give me the fleece now, I will make sure that your name is renowned throughout all of Hellas. And every Greek will know of your grandeur and your magnificence. And this is still not enough. In fact, it's so not enough that Aeetes, in the exact same way that Peleus had first sent Jason on this unwinnable quest, also sets Jason an unwinnable task, which is to yoke the bulls, which is to harness these giant fire-breathing bulls, because of course he has to, it's Greek mythology. And he also has to then plow the fields of Ares, and from those come the dragon teeth, and that brings about the Sown Men as well, who are, you know, obviously very supernatural. But thanks to, Jason succeeds in this, of course, thanks to the youngest daughter of Aeetes. He's betrayed from within by his own blood, because Medea is an acolyte of Hecate, who, you know, is quite wise.
Sorceress.
Yes, a sorceress goddess. Yeah. Who understands everything to do with potions and alchemy and witchcraft and the occult, you know, the arcane, the dark arts. And this makes Medea a very, very powerful woman in her own right. And she, thanks to the arrow that she took from Eros, is basically falls mad over heels in love with Jason and betrays her own father, betrays her own people, and is basically in the crosshairs of being ostracized from her own city.
Yeah.
Because she's aided Jason in this quest.
Yes. There are many layers in her betrayal.
Mm.
And that's where the question arises, where is her responsibility? Where is she responsible?
Mm.
And where isn't she responsible? We also have to mention that Aeetes also commits hubris.
Mm.
It's not just that, you know, he is rude and not a particularly good man.
Doesn't say please.
He gives a promise to Jason
that
he doesn't intend to keep. And he won't keep.
No.
He will break his promise. As someone else, who I am not going to mention right now to avoid spoilers, is going to do in what follows, which we are definitely going to touch upon.
Yeah, sure. The other thing as well, there was just another point with Aeetes as well, which is that when you go back to Book 3 and you look at the discussion between Hera and Athena, and they're trying to come up with a plan for, okay, what divine intervention can we bring that will make sure that Jason succeeds in his quest. And one of the things that they point to is the fact that they can't just convince Aeetes to give it up, right? So that actually goes to show there is a limit to the god's power. Aeetes is so strong-minded in like his manifest values that like it's not really possible. The smartest way to play it is to betray him from within. And even though Medea is very, very powerful, she is a more impressionable character because she is younger and she is a little bit green, right? She lives a very small life outside of the palace and the shrine. She's not a worldly person. And when she sees this, you know, this magnificent man, Jason, come out from, you know, this far-flung quest to her land in order to take the Golden Fleece, this creates obviously a great deal of turmoil in her.
And also it suggests that in that mindset, because on the one hand, you would say, well, why would Aeetes give the fleece to Jason? Just a random stranger coming out of nowhere, asking you your symbol of authority, just promising you good fame afterwards.
Especially when you are the son of the sun god. Yeah. When you are the son of Helios.
Yes.
Like, by what right are you asking him?
But the answer is, in this framework, is that this is divine will. So presumably, you know, if he is also a demigod, if you understand what I mean.
Yes.
So he should be more open to be convinced about that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
He should, you know, he should consult his oracle, let's say, at least. At least.
Get the oracle's note.
Yeah.
So let's start talking about book four, shall we? The final book in all of this. And I would just begin with the one paragraph from the beginning where Apollonius says, "You yourself, goddess, tell of the sufferings and thoughts of the Colchian girl. You muse, child of Zeus. Within me, my mind whirls in silent helplessness as I ponder whether I should call it the mad, sickening burden of desire or a shameful panic which caused her to abandon the tribe of the Colchians." And so we understand that this is the point in the story where Medea is going to abandon her people. And she does well to abandon her people as well. This is for her own self-preservation. This is the right decision because Aeetes, though he is volatile and petty and tyrannical, he's not a fool. He's not stupid. And he understands that Jason has only been able to accomplish the previous task in the Plains of Ares because Medea must have helped him, as she well did. You know, it was her who made him rub himself with these sacred oils and, you know, that made his armor, that made his weapons, you know, unbreakable. They got him on the tanning bed.
Yes.
And, you know, and it all worked out. So Aeetes understands that his daughter is complicit in what's just happened. And he seems to give absolutely no consideration for her feelings or her motivations of why she might have done this either, right? He's not interested in why something happened. He's only interested in the fact that it did happen. And so Medea, I think I spoke to earlier of it last time, but this is the point where she basically just kisses her bed. She leaves a lock of her own hair on her bed as well. And kind of, it's said in the text, maybe I'm just being dense. I don't quite understand how the message transfers across. But I think the implication from the text is that the lock of her hair is supposed to imply to her mother that she leaves behind, that she left a virgin, which is obviously important. But it's also symbolic of the fact that she is leaving her innocence behind, that her innocence is dying in this room. And for the first time in her life, Jason's arrival has forced her to take on an agency where she's not asking just what's good for my kingdom, what's good for Aeetes. She's asking what do I want in life, and what she wants, though divinely inflicted, is Jason.
It's hard to know what to make of it, because you could say that in a way her hair is a symbol of her femininity.
Mm.
That's a contentious point to make because men also had long hair
right
at the time. But this is something that it's like, you know, complete makeover.
Mm.
She leaves the world and she becomes a completely different person.
Yeah.
But she is very fierce. She isn't the typical woman.
No.
You could say Amazons were also fierce warriors, but she's going to be an incredibly fierce woman. She isn't the, you know, the average woman in the court of 80s.
Mm.
And you could say that she's leaving a part of her behind.
Yes.
That could be another way to think of it, that she has left a part of her behind, and she will always, she understands that she will always be a woman from Colchis.
Mm.
That's why when she goes to Greece and all the other places, she crosses the Balkans and then down to Italy and then to Libya. So sure. She's always the barbarian.
Mm. Yeah, she is the author in the story.
Thanks, Kimberly Crenshaw.
Yeah, another point in her story as well is that, you know, the fact that because she feels this pain and this suffering, right, that she is actually a woman who responds to that pain and suffering by taking action, right? She's a very active character in the story, and though she'll have her moments, and I've bookmarked them because they make for fantastic reading, I think as well that will foreshadow the later tragedy with Jason, when Jason puts her into that position of deep unhappiness, and we see the tragedy that will fall out there and that we'll discuss more broadly when we discuss Euripides' play, which is very much a sequel to this, though written before, of course. Anyway, so Medea decides to leave and she sneaks her way down to the docks of Colchis, and they're out, you know, just beyond the shallows. You've got the Argonauts, and she's waving and trying to gesture to them. And the youngest son of Phrixos, he sees her, and eventually they manage to bring Medea aboard. And at this point, of course, Medea is all in. You know, she's just putting all the chips on the table. She's like, look, I've betrayed my entire city. I've betrayed my father. You know, there's no room for half measures now. I'm in it. And if I get captured, you know, it's an unthinkable scenario. So let's just go to the Grove of Ares, confront the dragon, get the golden fleece. I will use my drugs to help with this, and let's just get the fleece and get out as quick as possible.
I like the scene where they go to the fleece and they marinate it. She marinates it.
Well, I was going to read it because it's fantastic. So it goes on to say, directly in front of them, the dragon stretched out its vast neck when its sharp eyes, which never sleep, spotted their approach. And its awful hissing resounded around the long reaches of the riverbank and the broad grove. It was heard by those who dwelled in that part of the Colchian land, which lies very far from Titania, beside the streams of the Lycos. This river breaks off from the crashing Araxes and unites its sacred stream with that of the Phasis to flow as one into the Caucasian Sea. Women who had just given birth awoke in terror and in panic threw their arms around their infant children, who slept in their arms and shivered at the hissing. As when vast, murky whirls of smoke roll above a forest which is burning and a never-ending stream spirals upwards from the ground, one quickly taking the place of another. So then did that monster uncurl its vast coils, which were covered with hard, dry scales. As it rolled towards them, the maiden fixed it in the eye and called in a lovely voice upon Sleep, the helper, the highest of the gods, to bewitch the beast. She invoked, too, the queen, the night wanderer, the infernal, the kindly one, to grant success to their enterprise. Behind her followed the son of Aeson, terrified. Already under the spell of the song, the dragon was relaxing the ridge of its earthborn coils, and it stretched out its numberless spirals, as when a black wave rolls weak and noiseless on a gentle sea. Even so, however, it lifted high its terrible head, seeking to enwrap them both in its deadly jaws. With a fresh-cut sprig of juniper, which had been dipped in a potion, Medea sprinkled powerful drugs over its eyes while she sang, and all around sleep was spread by the overwhelming scent of the drug. Just where it was, its jaw dropped to the earth, and far into the distance its countless spirals were stretched out through the thick wood. Then Jason removed the golden fleece from the oak at the maiden's instruction. She stayed where she was, rubbing the beast's head with the drug, until Jason gave the order to turn back towards the ship, and they left the deep-shaded grove of Ares. As when the young girl catches in her fine dress a gleam of the full moon hanging high over her bedroom under the roof, and her heart is delighted at the sight of the lovely radiance. Just so, then, did Jason rejoice as he lifted the great fleece in his hand, and over his fair cheeks and forehead, the sparkle of the wool threw a blush-like flame. And so, one thing to say is, this fleece is massive. Right, this is not an extra small. This is almost as big as Jason himself. It's bulky, it's grand. You can absolutely see not only in the gold of the fleece, but also in its size, how divine this fleece is. Another point that I would just be remiss not to add as well is that this entire episode, I can't help but be reminded of an event from the Silmarillion with Tolkien, where I would be really surprised if this wasn't influencing Tolkien in this, but when Beren and Lúthien smuggle their way into Angband to steal one of the Silmarils from Morgoth's crown, and when that happens, Lúthien sings Morgoth to sleep as Beren steals a priceless jewel. And so I think there's definitely a parallel there, and I think Tolkien was definitely drawing on this ancient tale for that part of the story. And that wouldn't surprise me either, because it's not the first time that he borrows from Greek mythology when it comes to constructing the Beren and Lúthien tale. He also does it as well when he has Lúthien break in to Tolin Galroth to rescue Beren from what is essentially hell, and which is obviously reminiscent of Orpheus's tale as well. Anyway, I've spoken.
Who's also there?
Who's also there? And yes,
he will help a lot.
Yes.
In the movie, it's Orpheus who is chanting the dragon.
I mean, I get why they've made that decision.
Yeah. Playing the lyre, and the dragon is just completely disarmed and
yeah. But there's two things really. One, I think the writing does a tremendous job of putting across the sheer terror of this beast. You know, and when it talks about people throughout the region waking up with the sound of it, one, that obviously alerts Aeetes and the rest of his men to the fact that the fleece is currently being stolen. But also as well, it makes you wonder, truly, what would Jason and the Argonauts have done there without Medea? How would they have, you know, finally overcome this hurdle? I mean, one, Jason would have already been dead, because he'd never have succeeded in the challenge that Aeetes threw down against him. But this is just another example where Medea's intervention is the very difference between survival and failure.
Yeah, on the other hand, you do have a strong crew. So I don't know if they would have found a way to deal with the dragon specifically.
But even if they did, what I'm thinking is, would they have done it in time before Aeetes and his men also got there to stop them? It's Medea who's able to do it so swiftly, to just literally force sleep upon a sleepless dragon, right? Yeah. It's all constantly described as it does not sleep. And yet Medea makes it sleep through the power of her drugs, which is, I mean, yeah, it's one hell of morphine. Hit, that's all I'll say. There is just another thing about the Golden Fleece as well, which I thought might be interesting to mention, which is that the ancient Greek geographer Strabo, he was a very, very well-travelled man back in his day, and there was an extract from his Geographica, that goes on to say, "It is said that in their country," meaning Georgia, where the story is currently set, gold is carried down by the mountain torrents, and that the barbarians obtain it by means of perforated troughs and fleecy skins, and that this is the origin of the myth of the Golden Fleece. Unless they call them Iberians by the same name as the Western Iberians from the gold mines in both countries. And so we see here Strabo offering a more anthropological explanation as to the creation of the fleece and how, you know, like it was conceived of in the minds of men that through whatever it was, this gold material that was flowing down from the mountains into the streams, and as they were washing their clothes in the water of the local, that it was creating a gold effect on their, as he says, their fleecy skins. Yeah. As Strabo puts it. And so I think that's quite a remarkable... I mean, it might be true, it might not be true, but I thought it was just worth putting out there as a point of interest.
I want to add to what you mentioned about the anthropological explanation that Apollonius writes in the... Is it 3rd or 2nd century BC?
Yeah, he's writing around just after, a generation after Alexander. Yeah.
There's a very great question about what is myth. Mm. And whether there is one thing or not. And you have people who say that there is an essence in myth and others who are saying that there isn't an essence in myth and there is a largely disconnected, decentralized mythological tradition, actually a multitude of traditions, not all of which have the same purpose.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.